Every election year, we get reminded that Americans do not agree on a lot of things, and often in the years between elections, for that matter. Sometimes it seems like the cycle never ends. How'd we get here? How'd we get so fractured? Today's guest takes up that issue in his book, The Fractured Republic, Renewing America's Social Contract in the Age of Individualism. Yuval Levin is the author. He's a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, a conservative think tank. He's also the founder and editor of National Affairs, a conservative quarterly. Yuval Levin has government experience, too, as a congressional staffer and part of the team in the George W. Bush White House. His writing also appears in the National Review and the Weekly Standard. Yuval Levin, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you very much for having me.
You write that your work would be easier if our public life were the scene of simple struggles between the righteous and the wrong. Not so simple, though, huh?
Yeah, you know, everybody in politics and a lot of people who just follow politics would always love to believe that the questions we confront are very easy and that the reason people disagree with us is that they're ill-intentioned. But, of course, politics is complex, and everybody only sees part of the picture. And so, especially in a moment like this, in an election year like this that is so aggressively confusing and frustrating, it simply can't be said that there's a right side and a wrong side and get on the right side or else. What has to be done is to understand how we've come here, the complicated story that's led us to this complicated moment, and that's what this book tries to get at.
That's a great term, aggressively confusing. You write that this is a failure of diagnosis and a failure of self-understanding. By whom, of what?
Yeah, you know, the trouble is almost everyone. So the book begins with the frustration that's really overwhelming our politics now, the sense that our institutions are breaking down, that our society is divided and polarized, in a sense that America just doesn't work the way it used to. It's certainly impossible to ignore that frustration. It's driving so much of what's going on in this election year. The book tries to ask, how did we get here, and how do we turn things around? And it starts by noticing that a lot of the ways that our politicians, both on the left and on the right, talk about the problems we have are deeply nostalgic. Everybody seems to talk in terms of America having lost ground from a height, from a peak that a lot of Americans can still remember. And when you listen to our politicians, a lot of them are really talking about that mid-century moment in America when the country was, in fact, incredibly cohesive, at least if you were a kind of white middle-class American. It seemed like a time when America was on top of the world. And when, in fact, there was a kind of broad moral consensus, things that conservatives might look to as advancing, thriving, like strong families, like low divorce rates, were very strong at that time. Things that liberals might look to, like low inequality and a kind of liberalizing of our culture, were beginning at that time. And so a lot of our politicians, especially those of them who are baby boomers, like the two presidential candidates we look likely to have this year, start out by talking to the country about how do we get back to that moment. And it seems to me that talking about how do we get back is the wrong way to think about this 21st century moment. And a lot of our frustration comes from that fact, that we're not really looking at the present.
So it really is a nostalgia kind of kick here. But politicians really sort of add to this, don't they? They never really do much more than talk in terms of there are simple solutions, that sort of thing.
Very much so. There's a kind of simple-minded way of thinking about how we solve problems that is often very deeply nostalgic. Donald Trump, of course, accentuates this by just outright saying he's going to make America great again. And when you ask him when was it great, as the New York Times did in April, he'll talk about the 1950s. Hillary Clinton's a little more implicit about it, but when you listen to a lot of economic arguments, especially on the left, there's a sense that at least since the end of the 60s, our economy has been failing working people. And there's a desire to return to that mid-century economy, which was heavily regulated, but at the same time also much less unequal. It's not that there's nothing to miss about that time. Certainly there is. The problem is going backward is not an option in the actual life of a free society. And the question is how do we reattain some of what we've lost by starting from here? And so the book really tries to ask, what is here? What does that mean? How has the country changed? And that's why it's called the Fractured Republic, because it seems to me that a lot of what has happened to American life since that mid-century moment is a kind of fragmentation, fracturing. What was a very cohesive, consolidated American society in that moment has broken down in ways that are actually both good and bad. We have much more diversity, but we do have less unity. We have a much more dynamic economy, but much less security for workers. And so a lot of the best of what we like about contemporary America is just the other side of the coin of what troubles us most. And, of course, that's what makes politics so frustrating.
With these fond looks back to earlier periods in American history, and certainly in our lifetimes or the lifetimes of some of us, there are still some blinders on here, aren't there? I mean, because,
absolutely,
you know, you can certainly have a person saying, well, I had it good back then. But then there are lots of other people probably at the same time who could say, I didn't.
Of course. Look at mid-century America, which, again, is such a focus point for nostalgia. If you were an African-American at that point, if you were a woman who wanted to work at that point, that's not the time you look back to. And it's really not just that. The consolidation of American life at that time meant that there were far fewer options than we now have, really in every realm of life, that American life was much more constricted. But we have this kind of baby boomer mentality, and not just the baby boomers themselves. This idea of what American life has been that's very much built up through the eyes of middle-class white American baby boomers. I'll give you an example. If you think about the life cycle of an average baby boomer, say somebody who was born in 1950, would now think of the 1950s through the eyes of a child, and so think of it as a kind of simple time when things were working. That's not a reality about the 1950s, not if you really look at the 50s, but so much of how we think about the last number of decades in our national life works through that kind of baby boomer mentality that really distorts how we understand our actual history.
That's a good point. The memories come from our childhoods and not from what it was like to live in those times as an adult, particularly an adult of color. We'll come back and talk more about The Fractured Republic, the book by Yuval Levin. He's our guest on The Exchange. We'll come back and take your phone calls and emails when we return to The Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Yuval Levin, the founder and editor of National Affairs, a conservative quarterly. He's written a book about the general state of American society at the moment called The Fractured Republic, Renewing America's Social Contract in the Age of Individualism. You can join this discussion on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. You're not the first person to point out the poles of collectivism and individualism. We had Colin Woodard on recently with American Character, but you dispute the notion that they're necessarily opposites.
Well, that's right. I think that it's not quite right to think that individualism and centralization, or some people might say individualism and a kind of collectivism, are opposites. Actually, those two have tended to very much work together in American life and in American history. As observers of American life since at least Robert Nisbet in the 50s, but really Alexis de Tocqueville in the 19th century, have argued individualism, the tendency people have to withdraw into their own private lives, tends actually to empower a centralized government over local communities or civil society. And at the same time, of course, the centralization of government itself tends to isolate people, tends to treat all Americans as only individuals. And so this tendency to, on the one hand, pull apart into our own individual experiences, and on the other hand, to pull upward toward a centralized government, tend to work together. And what's missing, what's undone by that process, is what's in the middle layers of American society, from the family to the community, to the church or synagogue, to the civic association, to the school, to the labor movement, to business interests. All of these things play a role when we centralize and when we individualize, but they don't play the central leading role in helping Americans solve problems that they otherwise might. And so the argument I make is really that if the challenge we face is how to solve our problems as a fractured society, as a fragmented society, then a certain amount of empowering of those middle layers, decentralizing government on the one hand, but also drawing isolated individuals into those institutions on the other, has to play a very important role in solving the kinds of problems we have, in dealing with entrenched poverty, in dealing with the challenges of immobility, in improving our schools, our welfare system, our healthcare system. There has to be much more of a role for the local and the near at hand, for the community, than we tend to assign in our politics now.
All right. So as you start at the local level, you work outward in a set of concentric rings you describe. Can you start from the middle and work us out?
Well, you know, so in a sense, American life might be thought of as a set of concentric rings. You might think of the rings around Saturn, beginning really from the family and the individuals that compose it, and then working outward toward the local community, towards broader institutions like religious communities and civic associations, toward organizations that bring together workers or that bring together business owners, and then outward toward more regional kinds of affinities, and finally outward toward the national government. And the reason it's useful, I think, to think in these terms, to kind of visualize American society this way, is that each of those rings is there to protect and sustain the space for the one before it. And so each of these institutions is really there to enable and protect what happens in the one that's closer down to the level of the individual. And ultimately, the national government should be understood as sustaining the space for civil society, sustaining the space for all of that to happen, rather than filling that space. And so it seems to me a mistake both to think first and foremost of national-level solutions, but also at the same time a mistake to think that if you just leave individuals to themselves, as a lot of people on the right sometimes think, everything will just resolve itself, and the only problem we have is that government keeps trying to interfere. A society is a complex organism. It's not just a bunch of individuals doing what they choose, but it's also not just a single government acting on behalf of everyone. American life has always worked best when it's been allowed to work in this complex way, but lately we've tended to overly centralize our public policy and to overly individuate our moral lives and our lives as citizens. And in both directions, this tends to kind of tear at the fabric of what should actually bring the strength of our society.
Yuval Levin is our guest on The Exchange. His book is The Fractured Republic. Where does that urge to centralize come from, though? Because, you know, it seems like lots of people would at least acknowledge on some level, yes, we should solve our problems locally, but they seem very uninterested in things like city council elections while everybody knows the name of the people running for president.
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of factors, of course. The book begins with a kind of history that tries to get at some of this, that suggests that, first of all, the urge to centralize came from a quite understandable progressive response to industrialization at the beginning of the last century, the beginning of the 20th century, when the scale of our economy grew so much so quickly that it seemed as though the scale of American politics just had to grow to respond to it. And there was this vast centralization, this sense that the federal government had to speak on behalf of the nation, and we had to address our problems that way. The way our economy works now is not quite so centralized and not quite so vast. In a lot of ways, our economy now is actually much more fragmented and much more personalized. And I think our politics should change in response. But obviously, that's easier said than done. You can't simply say that, well, if people started, you know, attending those city council meetings again or going to PTA meetings, they would magically solve all the problems we have. I think there's an important step in the middle by which public policy itself would have to be, to some degree, devolved and decentralized so that what happens in those middle institutions actually matters, that there's actual power and authority there to make a difference in people's lives. Because otherwise it's hard to blame people for not going to the city council meeting if all the city council really does is try to lobby the federal government for more money for one thing or another.
While there is some decentralization in the economy, I mean, more small entrepreneurs popping up, that sort of thing, the fact is we also have gigantic corporations and gigantic banks, you know, seen as too big to fail. I mean, we need to have, I mean, I'm sure there are some people who would advocate you need to have a government big enough to regulate them.
Yeah, no, and in this sense, I'm quite critical of today's right in the book, which is, it seems to me that conservatives have got to see that giantism in the corporate world is just about as much of a problem as giantism in government. And if we're going to have a public life that's brought down closer to the scale of the community, we also have to see that there are genuine challenges created by massive centralization of economic power. And so, to the extent that the federal government regulates the economy, it needs especially to emphasize competition rather than a kind of cronyism that empowers today's economic incumbents to grow stronger and bigger all the time, which unfortunately is what happens under both parties at this point.
Do we measure too much of our success in dollars, do you think? Is this one of the I mean, even driving to work this morning, hearing about the market dropping a bit, the jobs report was a little weaker than expected on Friday. This seems like it came only 2 weeks after consumer confidence was reported high.
Yeah, you know, we do sort of confuse ourselves and drive ourselves nuts by trying to follow the numbers. Of course, it helps to have some way to quantify some sense of whether things are going well or poorly in the country. But again, I think that if you allow people to make decisions nearer to the local level that matter, it will be easier for priorities that aren't simply money to be better expressed in our public policy and in our common life together, because people do prioritize in their own lives, and money is not always the top priority, needless to say. But when we think in these gigantic terms, and when every question is a national question, you almost have to have these mass measures of prosperity that stand in for measures of every other good thing. Sometimes that makes sense, but many times it doesn't.
Yuval Levin is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the author of the book, The Fractured Republic, Renewing America's Social Contract in the Age of Individualism. One of his main theses is that we're looking back fondly to times that may not have been so great after all, and we need to look forward instead. This period we tend to look back to so longingly, the 50s in particular, when you could get out of high school, go across the street to the factory, and probably close out your entire working life there at a decent rate of pay. That is no longer necessarily what happens here. But then that period itself, how sustainable was it? I mean, you had to figure out that 12 years of depression and war and pent-up demand would lead logically to an extended growth period, but not a permanent one.
Exactly. So the American economy, I think it's not often appreciated, in that period was extremely consolidated. It was heavily regulated. The kind of infrastructure of our economic life, transportation, communication, the financial system, were intensely regulated by the government, to the point where prices literally were being set by regulatory agencies. And at the same time, the United States had come out of a war where all of its competitors had basically burned each other's economies to the ground, but ours had only grown during those years. And so there was a period that followed where the United States just had a mind-boggling advantage, economic advantage, over the rest of the developed world. And that certainly did offer real opportunities. That was not a dream. That time was real. When people with low levels of skills and education and with high levels and with middling levels could all find career opportunities, that has changed. And there's no doubt that that's been an enormous cost of the progress the world has made, that the United States has had to specialize in somewhat higher skill work, which obviously leaves people with lower levels of education with fewer opportunities. The country has to respond to that by changing our education system, by helping people who don't have opportunities. But going back is really not an option. And so when you find in this election campaign Hillary Clinton promising to put America at the top of the world in terms of industrial manufacturing again, or when you find Donald Trump saying going to Pittsburgh and saying he's going to bring steel back, these are just lies. There's absolutely no way for that to happen. And citizens have got to come face to face with the fact that what their leaders are promising them at this point is a kind of nostalgic dream and not a response to 21st century circumstances that could really work in today's America.
So it may not be said by both sides, but there's some level of I want my country back on both ends of the political spectrum, which generally, as you pointed out, comes from boomers. I wonder to a younger person like yourself how this all strikes you. I mean, is there a period you look back to nostalgically?
Yeah, you know, well, at least not yet, right? I'd say I'm 39. I was born in the late 70s, and it is really striking how much of this powerful nostalgia does come from those baby boomers who, in a sense, are looking back to their own peak, though, of course, they are looking back to a time we can learn from and when America was successful in some important ways. But they're also, as you say, they don't recognize their country in some significant ways. And so a politician who looks around and the first thing he thinks to say is, I want my country back, is really not a person who's going to have an enormous amount to offer American life in the 21st century. And I think a new generation of leaders in both parties, people who are a little younger, and we don't have to wait for the millennials to be old enough to run for president. They almost are, I guess. But even people in their 40s, people in their early 50s in our politics, are just much more at home in American political life and American public life. They're not as struck by the sheer diversity of our society in a way that somebody who was formed in the 70s, say, would be. And we don't often think about how much that has changed, but those changes make an enormous difference. And we need a politics that is at home in today's America to address the problems that this country faces.
In a tour that you give us in the book of mid-century America and what led up to it, you go on a key riff here about the Constitution's approach to both populism and technocracy. Can you kind of walk us through that?
Yeah, you know, there's a sense in our politics that the choice we have is between populism or a kind of technocratic approach, between assuming that the people have all the answers and they need to be empowered as opposed to the elites on the one hand, or on the other hand, the notion that politics needs to be an application of expertise, that we have a kind of science of politics that can solve our problems. The American system of government is actually built in opposition to both of those views and sees them as something like two sides of the same coin. It neither trusts the people nor the leaders to have all the answers. It's rooted in the assumption that no one has all the answers, and so we need a system that forces us to think through large decisions, that makes it difficult for us to move quickly, and that allows input from both elites and the public before changes are made. I think we find now that there's an enormous amount of frustration with the way that system works, but ultimately it seems to me that system is basically right, that both the populist assumption, which we see playing out in this election, for instance, and the kind of technocratic assumption, which we've seen to some extent in the last 8 years in Washington, the idea that if you just let the experts manage the system, it'll all work well, those are both likely to be wrong. And a 21st century solution to that kind of problem would actually look a lot like the constitutional solution, which is, again, empowering the local as well as the national, allowing power to flow down as well as up. Federalism, subsidiarity, we can come up with a lot of names for it, but what it really means is that a lot of solutions are going to come from the bottom up in our society, and there's got to be room for those to emerge without either a kind of populism that crushes our politics or a technocratic approach that doesn't leave room for democracy.
So essentially it's built to be something that's hard to turn unless you get near unanimity, and that is very difficult to achieve.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. And so change is supposed to be slow. So if you feel frustrated by the pace of change, that's a feature, that's not a bug. The trouble is that at this point, we're not even using that system in the way that we might. And I think that the degree to which our politics is overwhelmed by nostalgia means that we're not asking the right questions of that system, let alone finding the right answers.
Yuval Levin is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Fractured Republic, Renewing America's Social Contract in the Age of Individualism. Here is Skeeter in Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Hiya.
Hi.
Thanks for a great program. Imagine if we got organized and we elected people to office and they put forth this proposal that we turn around our tax-paying structure so that the bulk of tax-paying money is kept in the neighborhoods. Some of it goes to state capitals, and a little bit goes to Washington, D.C. I imagine that if we somehow could do that, people knowing that our tax money is nearby and we have control over it, to take care of business and each other, I suspect that citizens would be participating a whole lot more. And also, if you could maybe comment on the whole concept of guaranteed annual income and whether or not this might facilitate people having more time to go to committee meetings.
I don't know about that. Let's find out, Skeeter. Thanks for the call.
Well, thanks very much. Two great questions, though in a way they are a little bit in tension with one another. The idea of a guaranteed income is actually a kind of great nationalization of our tax base. I think there's a lot of promise in both these ideas. And the notion of keeping more tax money local certainly appeals if what you want to do is enable local government to have more authority. The core argument against that idea is that it would empower wealthy communities to have better public services. And we see that in the way we fund education in America, for example, where people who live in communities that just have more money also have better schools. Schools are supposed to be the way up, the path to mobility, and so there's an obvious unfairness, if not injustice, in that way of funding things. So we would have to at least think about that and how to address it and equalize things some. But I do think that allowing more tax money to be spent at the local level, allowing more decisions to be made at the local level, would make an enormous difference in both the way that our public policy operates, the way that it can adapt itself to the immense diversity of challenges we face and strengths we have in our country, and also, as the caller says, in drawing people in and giving them a sense that what they do at the local level could matter, so it's worth their time, it's worth their effort. On the second question, I'm something of a skeptic of the universal income idea. I think it's a little too simple as a way of thinking about welfare, because a lot of the problems that people confront, especially those who face truly entrenched poverty, intergenerational poverty, that has to do with America's history of racial injustice, that has to do with the incredible difficulty in rising out of the lowest rungs in our society, are people who need more than money, and so who would require a welfare system that does a little more than just send everybody an equal check every month.
And I notice that even countries you might expect would go for such a thing, Switzerland just voted against the guaranteed annual income and voted overwhelmingly against it. Something like 3-1. We'll come back and talk more with Yuval Levin. His book is The Fractured Republic, Renewing America's Social Contract in the Age of Individualism. More calls and emails are welcome. We'll take those when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Yuval Levin, a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington. He's the editor of National Affairs, and he's the author of a new book called The Fractured Republic, Renewing America's Social Contract in the Age of Individualism. One of the major bones he picks in the book is with the tendency of people on both ends of the political spectrum to look back nostalgically instead of forward in America. Join us on the exchange with your perceptions, your questions, your comments at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. One of the things that is one of the measurements of the fracturing of American society is the confidence in institutions, which is really a striking figure. As you point out, 76% in 1964 said they trusted the federal government to do the right thing. Where's that figure now?
It's at about 12% as of 2012. It's an amazing thing. The University of Michigan does us all the enormous favor of asking a large sample of people the exact same questions every 4 years in every presidential election since the early 1950s. And one of the most striking things you find is this loss of faith in institutions, not just government, but large institutions of all kinds. Americans had incredible faith in those institutions at the middle of the 20th century, really quite astonishing faith that government working together with big business, together with big labor, could really address the challenges the country faced. And today, that trust in institutions is just at a dismal level. And that's government, but it's also business, it's also the press, it's also the academy. All of our large institutions just do not have the public's faith and trust. And the difference that makes is an enormous difference. I think it's worth seeing that it's actually that mid-century confidence that's the exception in America. In fact, the United States has not generally been that cohesive and unified as it was in those years and has not generally had that kind of faith in big institutions. I think if you had looked in on America at almost any point in the 19th century, we didn't have polling then to help us, but it seems awfully likely from the evidence we do have that, for example, faith in Congress would have been at about the level it is now, which is not that far from zero. And faith in a lot of institutions in America, the American public has always had this kind of populist streak. And mid-century America was an exception to it in a pretty dramatic way, and certainly that's part of what we miss, this sense of the very different country you were for that brief period.
So the fracturing, as in Fractured Republic, may in fact be a general state of affairs, and the aberration was the unity in the middle of the 20th century?
It's really my sense that that's what it is. The argument that the book makes is that in the first half of the 20th century, a lot of the most powerful forces in American life, social and economic and political and cultural, were driving Americans together, causing people to become more like everybody else. And that's because of industrialization, increasing the scale of our economy. It's because of progressive politics, but also genuinely mass media, giving people mass experiences together. And so the country that came out of that period, that came out of the war and the Depression, which of course also unified us, was a very unusually unified version of the United States. And since that time, almost all of those same forces, economic and social, cultural and political, have instead driven individualism, driven Americans to become not more like each other, but more like themselves. And so we've seen the profusion of options, the personalization of everything, but also polarization and a tendency of the left and the right, the top and the bottom, to drive away from each other. These are very powerful trends. They're not the product of any one single force, and they are, I think, the reality that our politics has to deal with, the things we have to take for granted in then turning around and seeing how do we use the strengths we get out of this reality, like diversity, like dynamism, to address the problems that it creates, like inequality or polarization or insecurity.
It's interesting when you put it that way, because then it gets to a point where you think that nobody on left or right should be surprised that the fragmenting happening, particularly happened when you have baby boomers in the 60s rebelling against the establishment, followed by through the 70s and into the 80s and producing Ronald Reagan, the view from the right that we could do things very differently. We should restructure the way things are done economically, for example.
Yeah, that's right. In a sense, the liberalization succeeded, both the social liberalization that a lot of people on the left wanted in the 60s and the economic liberalization that a lot of people on the right pushed for and began to really achieve in the 80s. Those have been successful, and the country we have is the result of that. What those forces did was take a very consolidated society and liberalize it in a variety of ways. Again, much of this has been very good. Some of it has been very bad. But in thinking about how to use the good to address the bad, we have to live in the present. And that's why nostalgia is such a barrier to clear thinking about politics now.
We have an email here from Jeffrey in Ashland. He asks, does Republican conservatism inherently look backwards? I see this in the right's inability to accept things like Roe versus Wade, or the insistence that trickle-down economics still works, or that religion has a place in government, ignoring separation of church and state, etc. Jeffrey in Ashland.
Yeah. Well, that last one is, of course, a well-rooted American principle, so I'm not sure it quite works the same way, but I take the point. I think that there is certainly something about conservatism, and I say that as a conservative, that inherently tries to look for enduring, timeless principles and to apply them to changing circumstances. The problem now is that I think conservatives in America have not been attuned enough to the changing circumstances, and so rather than apply enduring principles to changing times, we've tried to just replay the agenda of the 1980s over and over as the world has changed around it. And so you find conservatives too often speaking in the language of what was the conservative agenda 35 years ago. And that's not how conservatism succeeds. That's not how it is at its best. You know, conservatives look back to Ronald Reagan. Reagan did not stand before the country and say, let's do again in 1980 what we did in 1945. That's actually what it means for Ted Cruz to stand before the country and say now that we should repeat Reaganism. I think what conservatism could do if it were more like its best self is stand before the country and say the ideals that ground our Constitution, the principles behind our kind of republic, suggest a certain way of thinking about the problems we have. So let's gain a better understanding of the problems we have and then see how those principles could serve us. That's the kind of conservatism that I try to push for and that others do. It's unfortunately not the kind that's often presented to voters by Republican politicians.
Okay, well, let's take a question here that I think goes to an issue that gets us from the macro to the micro. Connie and Eugene, welcome to the exchange.
Right. Good morning, gentlemen. It's just a theory or a question, really, about the social dynamics of the home in terms of political involvement, et cetera. I'm a baby boomer, so when I was growing up, of course, in the 50s and the 60s, we had stay-at-home moms, and not saying that a tremendous number of women were not working at the time, especially poorer women or women just starting to develop professions. But you had this tremendous number of stay-at-home moms and working fathers. And so now, as we went through all those decades, we now have a lot of women, both very young as well as middle-aged women, working. We have some men staying at home. And then we have a curious upper and lower or different gradients of those stay-at-home moms. Many of them are socially conservative, and they've chosen to stay at home or their religion indicates they stay at home. And then upper-income women who've chosen, because they have enough money, to be able to stay at home. And so it would change the dynamics of who volunteers for things, who supports things, who has the time to be politically and socially involved. That's sort of my question.
All right, so we restructured society by restructuring the home. Thanks for that, Connie. Appreciate it. Thoughts, Yvonne?
Yeah, a very, very smart question, and thank you for it. I certainly think it's quite true that, first of all, it's obviously true that the structure of family life has been transformed quite profoundly for a lot of Americans, and that that has to have an effect on what our civic life looks like. But I would say that a lot of those stay-at-home moms, whether back then or now, are it's not the case that they just had a lot of time and could spend it volunteering. They did the work of caring for children and keeping the home, which is intense work and difficult work and time-consuming work. And so they're not necessarily working people today are not necessarily more at leisure or less at leisure than were stay-at-home parents back then, or vice versa. It seems to me that the difference has to do with the way we've come to think about what it means to be a responsible citizen, and that in that sense things have changed quite a bit. Not just from mid-century America, I would say. If you look at what sociologists were saying in the 1950s and 60s, someone like Robert Nisbet, with his wonderful book *The Quest for Community* in 1953, he was arguing then that civil society had been ground down and weakened and needed to be revived. That had been happening for half a century by then, and so in terms of recovering civil society, I wouldn't really say that mid-century America is a high point to look back to. And really, we shouldn't look back. We should think about how these kinds of institutions, whether new ones that are empowered by today's technologies, for instance, or whether a recovery of the city council and the church council and various voluntary organizations or labor unions or business groups can now help us to play a role in addressing the challenges we have in our communities. I do think that there are enough people with enough time, with enough resources to make that work. It's just they're not persuaded that that would be the best use of their time and their resources. And it seems to me that's what needs to change. It's an enormous challenge.
Yuval, you write that rebuilding the middle layers of American society requires pushing back against both individualism and statism. So what does that look like?
Yeah. Well, it demands different things of the right and the left, it seems to me. I think that there's an inclination on the left to think that when there's a problem, we need a federal program to deal with it. You see that embodied in this election in a variety of ways. But there's an inclination on the right to say that the proper response to an overly centralized government is a kind of radical individualism, is a reaction against all forms of collective action. And I think that's a mistake on both ends, and pushes us again toward that dichotomy that does us no good. There needs to be just a greater communitarianism on both the right and the left, and both do have traditions to draw on in looking for that recovery of communitarianism. We have had a communitarian left in America and a communitarian right in America. We really don't have either now. The right has a kind of libertarian tinge to it. And the left is awfully focused on federal programs as solutions. And so it seems to me that both sides have some work to do, and that for both it would involve first and foremost a coming to terms with the fragmentation, the fracture of our society. And the fact that we are a far more diverse society means that solving problems now requires empowering a diversity of problem solvers rather than hoping that one gets it right. And that will take a kind of change of mentality.
Does it require something as simple as getting to know your neighbors, beginning to build communities at a really atomic level?
Well, I think that's obviously an important first step for individuals, for families, to just get involved, to devote themselves where they can, where they have the time and the resources to devote themselves to their communities, to see where they can do good together. That's obviously the first step.
How do you sort out, then, which levels of government are best to handle the issues, again, in a country where many people vote for president, far fewer vote for Congress, and way far fewer in local elections?
Yeah. Well, you know, frankly, the answer is partly trial and error. I mean, I think that in figuring out how to solve these problems, it's not hard to persuade people that what we're doing now is not working very well. And so there is room for experimentation with different kinds of problem solving. Transportation, for example, is something we often think of as a federal responsibility. I think allowing states to have a lot more control over the money they send to Washington for transportation would help people see how state policy can make a difference. I think something similar with welfare and local government could help make a difference. It's really a matter of trial and error, and you know, that's the frustrating thing about it, but it's also the promising thing about it, because ultimately that's how we find solutions.
So elections not necessarily the only place to find solutions, obviously, but we've got a big one coming up this year. In our diffusion of society, Yuval, does it more or less require candidates to stoke resentments in order to get voters to pick sides?
Well, you know, it doesn't have to, but I think that's how it's played out. And so this is an election we're coming to now, a presidential election, where I am a very frustrated voter. And neither major party's candidate is, frankly, someone that I would vote for president. That, to me, is a suggestion that this kind of the 20th century structure of our politics is really reaching a kind of cratering point. I don't think this election is an example of the next phase of our politics. I think it's the end of the last phase, and that the sheer insufficiency of what's being offered to us is going to force us to think about what alternatives could look like. And so there's some promise in it that way, but boy, it is a frustrating election year for this voter.
Is it something like the last gasp of baby boomers or something, you think?
My sense is it could be. You know, if you think about where we'll be in the fall, most likely, we'll basically have two just about 70-year-old presidential candidates yelling at each other about how best to go backward. That's not a great picture.
Well, then how to go forwards on something like income equality, because that's going to be a big one this year, income inequality.
Yeah, well, again, I think it's a matter of the core problem that we often call income inequality is also a function of income immobility, of the fact that it's so hard to rise at the bottom of our society, which I think is really what troubles so many Americans about the distance between the top and the bottom. And thinking about mobility, thinking about how to improve public policy to better enable mobility, it seems to me does require a kind of decentralization of how we think about welfare policy, of how we think about tax policy, as a previous caller suggested. It's not all about which president is going to have all the answers. None of them will.
That is true. The book is called The Fractured Republic, Renewing America's Social Contract in the Age of Individualism. Yuval Levin wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Yuval, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.